Well, how is everyone this morning? Well, this is my last day, so you'll soon be shed of me. I think, far as I know, how we're... Well, hey, I've enjoyed it. I really appreciate the opportunity. It reminds me of all those years I taught and whatnot. And when I'd sit at the table writing a lecture, I'd think, you know, this is just like what I did for 40-some-odd years. Well, I don't know about that, Tommy. Some of this stuff ought to be burned, probably, or might be burned if it went public. Frank, would you lead us in an opening prayer? And we have a request to pray for Annie and Cricket Mullins. Well, today what I would like to do is to say a little something about the Gospels of Matthew, Luke, and John, and a word or two about the book of Revelation, and then kind of how the particular 27 books that we know as the New Testament came into being. Now, the Gospel of Matthew, like so many other books in the New Testament and in Old Testament too, does not state specifically its authorship. But of course, it is generally attributed to Matthew, who we know is one of the original 12 disciples of Jesus. Matthew is mentioned by name only on 5 occasions in the New Testament, and very little is known about his life. He was given the birth name of Levi and was the son of Alphaeus of Capernaum, but once he joined Jesus' group, as others were, he became known by a different name, and that was Matthew. Now, what was Matthew by profession? The Bible is very specific. He was a publican or tax collector. Now, tax collectors were unpopular. Thank goodness today we never say anything bad about state or federal taxes, do we? Particularly this time of the year, you know. But especially were Jews reviled who became Roman tax collectors because they were in cahoots, so to speak, with the overlord or the Roman Empire. Now, Rome had several categories of taxes. The basic taxes were the poll or head tax, a tax you paid simply because you existed. And the other one was a direct tax on land. Now, Roman officials themselves collected these taxes. But it was commonplace not only for the Romans, but for many, many centuries following that, for governments, the French were notorious for it in the 18th century, for example, to do what we call they farmed out their taxes. Yeah, so he's a tax farmer in this area. Well, what does that mean? You bid to collect a particular tax, and you paid the government up front a lump sum. Then you collected, and whatever you collected over was your profit. Or if you failed to collect the amount you bid, that was just tough luck. Now, there were certain advantages to this. The government received in a lump sum a certain amount of revenues it could go ahead and begin to spend, and it did not pay another class of tax collectors out of its own treasury, so to speak. Now, there's no reason to believe that Matthew was an unscrupulous tax collector, although many were notorious for exacting more than they should have in order to fatten their profits, so to speak. But nevertheless, how did other Jews react to Jesus selecting a tax collector, and particularly when he agreed to go into that individual's home to eat a meal? Now, eating a meal with someone is rather special, is it not? You just don't invite everyone to your table. Were they happy about that? Did they think it was the right thing to do? No, not at all. Let me read you just a couple of verses from chapter 9 of Matthew. My eyes aren't what they used to be. Let me find it here, beginning with 9 through 13. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. "Follow me," he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciple, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" On hearing this, Jesus said, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Now, I don't know that that necessarily implies that Matthew was a sinner any more than any other person was a sinner in this period. I don't know that we should automatically say that Matthew was sinning in his capacity as a tax collector. Now, the Gospels, as well as the book of Acts, rarely mention Matthew's activities as a part of Jesus' set of disciples. But this is also true of others. You know, not all of the 12 were given equal billing, were they not, in the various Gospels. He certainly witnessed many of the miracles Jesus performed and listened to his parables and sermons. He also witnessed the resurrected Jesus and his ascension into heaven. But like the rest of the disciples, as a part of the Great Commission, he did go out and perform teaching duties, a personal ministry. He was a missionary. And he was a very active missionary in the early days of the church. Various sources place him teaching to Jewish Christian groups in Judea and later in the Middle East, most notably Antioch in Syria, Macedonia in Europe, and Ethiopia in Africa. Tradition states that Matthew, like so many other apostles, was martyred. And in this particular instance, martyred in Ethiopia upon the orders of Hulakon, the leader of that country. Now, the Gospel of Matthew is believed to be the second oldest gospel, perhaps written somewhere between 75 and 85 A.D., Some biblical scholars believe he wrote it while working with a recently established Jewish Christian congregation in Antioch. What sources did he use? Well, he made extensive use of the earlier Gospel of Mark. He possibly used a great deal of the oral tradition of the day. And it is also suggested he may have had access to that source, which, if it had ever existed, certainly does not today, that we call Q, or Quell, which was a supposedly a book of sayings, of actions of Jesus that was circulating at the time, but no copy of it survived to the modern world. Now, in his gospel, he does provide a very rich description of the genealogy of Christ and the birth of Jesus. He will also describe the Sermon on the Mount, which was not covered in Mark. And Matthew's text is the only one to describe Jesus' Great Commission. Probably because of his original audience. Who was he writing for? He was writing to an early Jewish Christian group, many of whom may still have been worshiping in the synagogue as well as in the first homes that were being opened. And this is based upon the fact that more so than the other gospel writers, he includes things that would be familiar to Jews. He makes more use of quotations from the Old Testament and Jewish traditions and cultures. Now, he is also very critical of the Pharisees. Now, the Gospel of Matthew was widely copied. It became very popular rather quickly, circulated among a number of churches, and became one of the primary teaching tools of early church leaders. It will be used perhaps first by Jews who are embracing Christianity, but will later be used as the missionaries go more and more to the future of the church, which is the Gentile population. Its popularity with early church leaders and teachers may be the reason that it is included first. Not that it was the first reading, but it was a very popular and well-used one. Now, modern scholars are divided on whether or not the Apostle Matthew wrote the book that bears his name. Traditionally, it has been attributed to him, but the reason some doubt it is that why would an original disciple himself, as Matthew was, rely so much on Mark, who was not a disciple and did not firsthand witness the events of Jesus' ministry? The answer that many use to say, well, it was for this reason. And that reason is that from whom did Mark take so much of his information? What primary witness did he rely so heavily upon? Peter. And Peter was so well respected, and apparently Matthew respected him. He had been a co-disciple with him. That reliance on Peter may lead to this observation that some have made. Matthew often does not sound like what you would expect an actual witness to sound like, almost as though he's recounting it all secondhand. Does this prove or disprove that he was the author? I'm not sure. The problem arises in that these people in this time so often do not, as we do today, and it didn't become the traditional practice until later, to have what we call Christian and surnames. For example, this problem arises with John. There are several Johns. Which John are we talking about? Which Matthew are we talking about? That sort of thing. One of the common ways you handle that, and often you find it in the biblical literature, is when you mention a person's name, you say the son of whoever his father was, or the son of his father and mother. Let's turn next to the Gospel of Luke. Sure.
The genealogies.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an effort on the part of the writer to establish the credentials of Christ. he must be traced back to David, for example. I suspect that much of this was in the oral tradition of the Jews. Much of it had perhaps been written down by earlier Jewish scribes and writers. They put a great emphasis on that. The problem is, if you're one genealogy works up to Joseph, the other one works back through Mary. One goes back to David, the other genealogy, you know, Luke and Matthew are the ones that give the two genealogies. If you work it up to Joseph, of course, then if Joseph is not his father, why are you even putting it in there? You know, that kind of negates or offsets the assertion that the Holy Spirit impregnated Mary, if you want to put it that way. But I think it was very traditional with the Jewish people at the time to know their genealogy. Now, one of the things I used to do, particularly when I taught Tennessee history, was to ask my students, who is your great-grandfather? And you would be surprised how many of them could not. They didn't know where their family came from. Now, I realize that in modern times, the progressive phenomenon of children produced out of wedlock, divorces, broken families, and all of this, and I think our generation is, not us so much, we're all a bunch of old fogies, and we look backward. So many people today don't look backward. They look so much to the present and future. But I suspect that all of you know who your great-grandfather and great-grandmother were, do you not? When you go out and ask young people on the streets today, and you'll be surprised how many do not know that. Any other questions that I might address? Okay, let's turn to the Gospel of Luke. The Gospel of Luke is what is, some say, the first volume in a two-volume work, with Acts, the Acts of the Apostles, being the second volume. We know relatively little about Luke. There are only a few direct references to him in the New Testament, and those are largely supplied by whom? What apostle, not one of the original? He is so associated with Paul. Paul speaks of him in several of his epistles, and there are certain associations with Paul in the book of Acts. Now, Paul refers to Luke as a beloved physician in the book of Colossians. But aside from that, we don't have any other real proof that he was a physician, although St. Luke is the patron saint of doctors and surgeons today. Now, some biblical scholars state that he was a Gentile who converted to Christianity, thus making him the only Gentile to write a book in the New Testament. He is believed to come from Antioch. Most sources indicate that he never married, and that he was a very well-educated individual. Scholars place the writing of Luke's gospel at about 80 to 95 A.D., with most favoring the mid-80s as the time. But as in so many instances, you know, these weren't immediately published by a publishing house with a date of publication put on the front page of it. They're about the mid-80s, most things. Now, we all know how he begins, how he sets about to perform a better job, a more systematic job, of producing an account of Christ's life than others have done. I don't know that that is inherently a criticism. He is just trying to establish the care with which he has approached the subject, and utilizing perhaps more sources. Now, he is clearly better organized in his book. He has more depth in his historical approach. He also, some say, displays the most masterful literary style of any author in the New Testament. Now, Luke does make use of materials previously not used by either Matthew or Mark. He still probably uses the Q source as well. And some say that he drew heavily upon Mary, the mother of Jesus. Now, whether that is true or not, I'm not sure. Some say that his mother apparently had met her or knew her. Some even go so far as to say they are related, but in that case, I don't know that he is a Gentile, a pure Gentile at that. So I think that is questionable. Now, his gospel is clearly directed towards a Gentile group, congregation, or audience. And it may very well be that it was originally written for a church founded by Paul. Now, this conclusion is largely based upon his avoidance, his use of few references or examples taken from Old Testament literature and Jewish traditions and cultures, unlike Matthew's. He does present some new parables of Jesus. He stresses spiritual songs and praises. He also puts emphasis on prayer and joy in his narrative. Now, he, like Matthew, provides more background as well as another birth and infancy childhood narrative, unlike Mark and John. And he, interestingly, also includes a substantial amount of material on the background, the genealogy of John the Baptist. Now, Luke is not only, I think, a very literary, easily readable author of the New Testament works, but he, in terms of volume, produces more than any other writer. When you combine the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts, you have almost 30% of the material in the New Testament. Now, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the so-called three synoptic gospels. That term is derived from a Greek word meaning togetherness. They're very different from the Gospel of John. And much of biblical study about Christ by scholars, academicians, and others is by putting those three gospels side by side and then going through them to try to weave an integrated account. Or to say, well, now he said this, does that conflict with that, or does that support that? If you ever hear the phrase, the synoptic issue, that's what is being referenced, the comparative use of the three gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Now, John writes a far different type of gospel, and I want to say a few words about it and the book of Revelations. Now, these two works are traditionally attributed to John the Apostle along with three letters in the New Testament. Like some of the other apostles, he came from rather humble origins. Rather recently, I watched a presentation on the History Channel that covered the ministry of Christ. Any of you see that? And one of the things it emphasized is the nature of who Christ called to be his disciples. And to the people that Christ ministered, if you will, they are all marginal. They come from rather humble backgrounds, very little education, and more so than other Jews, tended to suffer economically and otherwise at the hands of the Roman officials and Roman Empire. John, like others, was a fisherman from Capernaum. Peter and Andrew were also from that class. But unlike, let us say, Matthew, for example, John is one of those apostles most frequently mentioned in the New Testament, in the Gospels, along with Peter and James. They constitute almost an inner circle within. I don't want to say clique, but many times when Jesus wanted to be off with himself, but not by himself, but not entirely alone, he carried them with him. And these three will witness the transfiguration of Jesus as well as his crucifixion. And John plays a rather major role in the history and activities of the early Christian church. In terms of his teachings, in terms of his suffering imprisonment on one occasion with Peter, and it is believed that he spent a great deal of time in Ephesus teaching, living there, and some say this may be the location in which he actually wrote his books. And another interesting thing about John is this in popular tradition. He is the only disciple who died what? A natural death, if you discount the suicide of Judas. All the others were martyred. And he lived a very long life. I saw this set of birth and death dates of 6 CE to 94. Or some authors, writers also say, born in the first decade of the Common Era, he died at, quote, the turn of the century. Now, what do they mean by that? Was it 98 CE or 102 CE? I'm not sure. But he lived, of course, longer and witnessed other events. And this could very particularly be important in both of these writing efforts. Now, some sources say that John was asked by high-ranking church leaders or early congregational leaders at some point in the 90s CE or AD to write an account of Jesus that would combat a current heresy. A Jewish Christian sect, the Ebionites, was contending that Jesus does not predate Mary, but you must mark the beginning of this entity, Jesus, with his birth. All right, turn to John. The Word becomes flesh. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness had not understood it. Now, from that point, John begins to address John the Baptist. In other words, this is going to be a very, very, very different account of Jesus than the three previous Gospels. It is a much more theological account. Gospel of John does have a great deal of information about Jesus, which is not found in the Synoptic Gospels. But that was not the real reason he wrote it, to provide fresh material, but I think to provide a fresh perspective, a fresh way to look at Jesus. The Gospel of John is a progressive glorification of Jesus to the cross and beyond. John in this work stresses signs or miracles which he believes pointed to Jesus' real identity as God. At times, the Gospel of John is very hostile to Jews who rejected Jesus as the Messiah, pointing to the difficulties that existed between Jews and Jewish Christians in his day, pointing to such things as that heresy of saying Jesus does not predate Mary, and other issues that arose and are coming to a conclusion. So many of the first Christians did not immediately cease the observation of Jewish practices. It's feast days, going to the synagogue, and then also meeting on the first day of the week, and ultimately with different feast days. In other words, for a while there, you know, they were both of some, so to speak, were they not? They had been reared, if they particularly were faithful, they had been doing this, and yet they believe, but it's going to take a transitional time to move away. And ultimately, with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, with certain actions by the Roman authorities and persecution and all of that, we began to get a pulling away. So that within, certainly by the end of the second century, you have a strong divide between the Christian community and the Jewish community. There are many other things that we can note about the gospel. John is the only one to say that Jesus' ministry lasted for 3 years. And as I recall, he's the only one that has the miracle of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, which is very different from the other general miracles described in the other gospels. Now, the book of John, I think, is one that makes you read and think in a somewhat different channel than or vein than when you're reading one of the synoptic gospels. Now, John is also said to be the author of Revelations. Now, how many of you have read Revelations recently? When I was trying to put just a few words down, I got, when was the last time I read Revelations? And I couldn't remember. So I sat down the other night and read it. And when I finished, I thought, you know, I've never really understood all that's going on in here. And maybe with each reading, We see something new, but it's a very aggressive book, is it not? It's a very hostile book in certain ways. The author is mad about something, very angry. Now, first of all, there is considerable controversy over whether John the Apostle wrote Revelations. If you date Revelation at some point by in the 90s, and you date the Gospel of John at that same period, here is a man who is very active in the last years of his life writing, even if he's dictating to a scribe or something like that. In recent years, biblical scholars have talked more and more about a John referred to as John the Divine to distinguish him from John the Apostle as the possible author of Revelation. Stressing writing style, comparative analysis, literary analysis, all of that. But if we accept it as divinely inspired literature, it doesn't really matter who the author was. We're not always going to have all of the answers. Well, why was the book written? Most agree that it was written by whomever because they were outraged. They were furious at the increase in persecution occurring under the Roman Emperor Domitian in the 80s and 90s, and also pushing more and more the concept of emperor worship, which was, of course, contrary to both Jewish and Christian beliefs. The book contains a cosmic vision, a struggle of forces in end times, and ultimately the triumphant victory of God over evil and a final judgment. The vision represents a victory over tyrannical Babylon, and that is a term to describe Rome, or sometimes they use the word the great prostitute to describe or symbolize Rome. But what is unique in this book is that in the preceding decades, understanding the potential danger to them, and particularly with the recent example of thousands of Jews being killed in Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple and the growing potential hostility of Roman authorities against this new sect, this new group, you know, the Romans are the potentially greatest enemy to the survival of Christianity, and ultimately, with their adoption of it, they ensure its survival, so to speak. There's this kind of unique play of words. But this author repeatedly calls Jesus what? That he has not been called in the past. The King of the Jews. Well, he puts emphasis on that. The King, more so than any others. Which would be an affront to Roman authorities, which is denying their pushing of their emperor worship. Now, once Rome had fallen, and this book by that time had become a canonical book in the Bible, that doesn't mean that the usefulness or the applicability of Revelation is gone. It now simply will be used by others to analyze, assess, or argue against various other worldly empires that can appear. And, of course, I think in our time it has come to be so much used in the increased popularity of both popular and religious groups emphasizing the end times. Now, how does the New Testament emerge in a final form? Over a period of time, during this same period I've been loosely covering, from let us say the late 40s to about 100 AD or CE, there have been all kinds of books emerging, perhaps hundreds of books, most of which probably haven't survived. But only 27 of these works will ultimately be included, will only be accepted as proper or canonical. Now, for years, many of these works were copied, circulated, came to be used in worship. Some came to be kind of lumped together. Particularly was it not uncommon to find people gathering epistles of Paul. A new form is coming into being during this period. The New Testament, and then ultimately the Bible, is going to become not a book of scrolls, but a book with pages. And parchment will emerge as the primary thing to write on rather than a papyrus scroll over time. There was never a coordinated, directed effort. There was never, in essence, a committee appointed to select the books. For hundreds of years, various books were used, but there began to emerge kind of an unspoken consensus of sorts. Again and again, as you moved about, these were the primary books you were finding that were being used. The first known exact listing of the 27 books that ultimately became accepted as the New Testament did not appear until 367 A.D. And it was included in a letter, an Easter letter, written by a North African bishop, Bishop Athanasius of Egypt. In his letter, he said, quote, "As the heretics are quoting apocryphal writings, an evil that was widespread even as early as when St. Luke wrote his gospel, there I have thought it good to clearly define what books have been received by us through tradition as belonging to the canon which we believe to be divine." End of quote. Now, what he selected, those 27 that he selected, were those that had basically been, through tradition, use, and study, accepted as valid, as divine, the prevailing view of most congregations. Now, this doesn't mean that all the others that had appeared, such as the Gospel of Thomas, the Shepherd of Hermes, the Gospel of Mary, Paul and Thecla, and on, had suddenly disappeared. They weren't being used by some here and there. But these 27 were the ones most commonly used, most generally thought to be valid and divine. Two conferences of North African bishops, in other words, the North African bishops, not Rome, is going to make this decision. It's later going to be verified. But the conference of Hippo in 393 and the conference in Carthage 4 years later in 397 accepted those 27 works first proposed a couple of decades earlier as canonical. And by that action, in essence, the New Testament is created. It will be some time before the old and new are brought together. If we had more time, an interesting thing is occurring aside from the Christian faith. With the destruction of the temple in 70 A.D. and other actions of the Roman authorities, we have the disappearance of the Sadducees and we have the beginnings of a modern rabbinical tradition among those who remain Jewish and are to be born Jews in the future. They will also, in the 100s, 200s, seek to modify their script some more. They will seek to standardize and accept, kind of finalize a new version of the Old Testament that's somewhat different from the Septuagint or the Greek translation. So there are developments occurring there. Well, that's it. Any questions or comments? As far as I know, however, we'll be back next week. I've enjoyed very much talking to you. God bless. Now, one thing I did is I always say, doubt things, question things. And in saying that, I don't mean that I don't want you to be like me. I mean, I've always had problems just accepting everything in the Bible 100%. You know, I'm never questioning. I don't think it's sinful to question. Now, you can't go too far. You can't, you know. But, you know, read critically. And as you read and reread, your understanding ought to deepen. And if it never changes from, if it never changes from the time you were 66 years old until you're 66 years old, and there's a problem somewhere in there. You see what I'm saying? You know, you know, that's what I think we need to be open-minded. God bless the Queen. I'll see you next time.